Well, the work I'm going to talk about was collaborations with my advisor Igor Klebanov, with Alexander Polyakov, Aki Hashimoto, and Michael Krasnitz. And I'll talk mostly about this first paper, which was the one with Polyakov and Klebanov, draw briefly on the middle two, and also talk about the last one, which was with Aki Hashimoto. I'll start by reviewing very briefly absorption cross-section calculations for the D3 brain. Since Igor spoke about those in his talk, I will be very brief. Mainly, I'll try to indicate how, from the supergravity analysis, Mathieu functions arise, and how, from the gauge theory analysis, two-point Green's functions are to be studied. Then the main part of my talk will be to describe the holographic prescription for computing gauge theory correlators from supergravity. I'll give the general formula for the generating function of connected Green's functions, and then as a simple application, discuss the two-point function and the mass-dimension relation. And then at the end of my talk, if I have time, I'll return to the Mathieu function calculation and discuss some potential world volume implications of the exact energy dependence of the absorption cross-section. Well, so to start on the supergravity, as Igor described, the D3 brain is geometry which is supported by the Ramondre-Mohm 5-form field strength flux. And there are several, in the presence of this solution of type 2B supergravity, there are several fields whose linearized equations of motion are simply the Laplace equation. And these I will call minimal scalars. Examples would include the dilaton, the axion, and longitudinally polarized gravitons with their momentum perpendicular to the brain. Now, you can solve this Laplace equation by separation of variables since the geometry is spherically symmetric. And the entertaining fact is that the radial function turns out to be nothing but Mathieu functions. So the potential barrier that Igor drew for you in his talk can be manipulated into a much simpler form by a change of radial variable. That potential barrier just becomes minus the hyperbolic cosine if you define a new radial variable, which is essentially the log of the old radial variable. So now the absorption probability is nothing but a tunneling probability. You can just compute it as a square of a transmission coefficient in a one-dimensional Schrodinger problem. Now, the solution to this Schrodinger problem when the potential is of the form cosh is the tunneling solution is known to 19th century mathematicians as an associated Mathieu function of the third kind. And then the tunneling probability can be written as a power series in omega r, where omega is the energy and r is the radius of the phi sphere. But in the term in that power series, with 4n powers of omega, there can also be as many as n powers of the logarithm of omega. Now, I cannot sum this series or give even a closed form for the coefficients b and k, but I can give an algorithm for computing them, and they turn out to be simple rational numbers for low values of n and k. Well, the absorption cross-section for the Lth partial wave now follows directly from the optical theorem. And the game now is to try to compare it to something in gauge theory. Well, as we shall see, in renormalizable gauge theory, you can only expect to get the first term of that series expansion, and we'll see why very shortly. Well, again, as Igor explained, the dynamics of n-coincident D3 brains is governed by n equals 4 UN super Yang-Mills theory. And so the part of the action relevant to absorption is the kinetic term for the dilaton propagating in the bulk, the action for the 3-brain, just super Yang-Mills theory, and then an interaction between the two, which we retain only to linear order in the dilaton field as appropriate to absorption of a single quanta of the dilaton. Now, this interaction term, which is the key to the whole game, can be quite difficult to decipher, as Samir was, as it was indicating in his lecture yesterday. However, for the fields that I'm interested in today, it's fairly straightforward. For instance, the graviton couples with the stress tensor, the axion acts as a dynamical theta parameter in the gauge theory, and the dilaton is related to the string to the gauge coupling. Well, let's see how I'm doing on time. Okay, having established the form of this coupling, that coupling then mediates the absorption process by the Feynman diagram that I've shown. And instead of trying to calculate the tree-level amplitude directly, it's much more efficient to consider the discontinuity in the cut of a two-point function of the operator O in the gauge theory. And again, Igor discussed this, so I'll be very brief. The easiest case to consider, or the easiest case intuitively to explain, is the graviton, because then the two-point function of the stress tensor is related to, in fact, the one-point function of the trace of the stress tensor by some conformal Ward identities. And the coefficients in the expansion of this VEV in arbitrary curved background are, in fact, anomaly coefficients. And they can be shown to depend for the n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory simply on the free field content. In short, the two-point function of the stress energy tensor can be computed exactly at one loop and suffers no radiated corrections. In other words, it does not matter what region of the coupling we're considering. We can compute this. We can compute this correlator as if it were free field theory. When you do so, indeed, you find perfect agreement with supergravity, but again, only to leading order in the energy. To put this in a slightly more mathematical form, as you take omega r to zero, the absorption probability vanishes as omega r to the eighth. So there is a certain decoupling limit. Low energy is a decoupling limit between the bulk and the brain. However, in this limit where the absorption probability vanishes, you can nevertheless form a finite quantity by dividing the cross-section by the gravitational coupling squared, multiplying by the energy. When you do, the finite limit is a discontinuity in the two-point function of an operator in the renormalizable gauge theory. This, to me, is the embryonic version of the holographic prescription for computing correlators, which I'll discuss in a moment. But the key ingredient to that prescription that was missing was supplied by Maldacena. He pointed out that the string theory gauge theory connection can be accessed in a much more direct fashion by considering the near horizon geometry. So to do that, let's define a radial variable z, which is 1 over our old radial variable. And note that the near horizon geometry is ADS5 cross S5. I will usually find it convenient to Wick rotate time to Euclidean time and obtain Lobachevsky space, which is one sheet of the two-sheeted hyperboloid in R5, 1. Well, the bosonic symmetries of n equals 4 super Young-Mills are realized as isometries of ADS5 cross S5 and the supersymmetries as killing spinners. So this gives us some hope just on group theory grounds that there should be some correspondence between the theories. But as we'll see, there's much more to it than that. I find it useful in actual calculations to retain the cutoff to cut off the geometry at a fixed radius z equals r. This helps preserve the correct order of limits when you finally come to compute correlation functions, and in effect you can think of it as an ultraviolet regulator in the conformal field theory. Only the final limit where omega r goes to zero is expected to be conformal. That's reflected geometrically by the fact that this so-called horosphere, the dotted red line, is not preserved by the full conformal group SO4, 2. So now to get to the main claim, if phi is a field of supergravity, which acts on the brain as a source for some composite color singulate operator O, then the supergravity action extremized subject to boundary conditions on the supergravity field is a generating functional of connected Green's functions of the operator O in the gauge theory. So to put that into symbols, W is our generating functional of connected Green's functions, and it is assumed to be the extremum of the supergravity action subject to boundary conditions on the field imposed at our chosen horosphere z equals r. Well, just as an aside, I would mention that one can notice a certain formal similarity between this holographic prescription for Green's functions and the old Gibbons-Hawking prescription for computing black hole entropy from the Euclidean action. which Igor discussed at the end of his talk. In the Hawking-Gibbons prescription, one identified the Euclidean action with the free energy divided by the temperature. And here we're doing almost the same thing, except we have a zero-temperature theory, and we're considering it subject to some boundary conditions on sources for composite operators. Well, in what regime do we really trust this so-called holographic prescription? Well, we should trust it only when the supergravity is a valid approximation to the string theory, namely when the radius of the anti-de Sitter space cross S5 is much greater than the string length and much greater than the Planck length. Otherwise, if that's not the case, we would have to use the full type 2b string theory amplitudes in place of the supergravity action. You can draw this. You can draw the parameters of type 2b string theory on a two-dimensional graph, where on the vertical axis I have the gravitational coupling kappa, that's the square root of the Newton constant, and on the horizontal axis I have alpha prime. So what I'm saying is that the prescription that I gave for computing arbitrary Green's functions in gauge theory from supergravity is only valid in the lower left-hand corner. And when you translate these quantities into gauge theory quantities, alpha prime becomes 1 over the Tuft coupling, and kappa becomes 1 over the rank of the gauge group. And so one is led to the conclusion that 1 over n corrections to the correlators would be reflected by quantum loop effects in supergravity, while expanding in strong coupling in the gauge theory amounts to alpha prime corrections to supergravity. Now, in general, actually calculating either the loop corrections or the alpha prime corrections is a difficult task. However, as Igor explained, we were able to compute the leading alpha prime correction for the entropy using the low energy string effect of action with alpha prime corrections. So in other words, we managed to move a little ways away along the horizontal axis. We were not considering motion in the vertical direction. However, as I think Andy and Juan were suggesting, one would expect to find some variation of the entropy as one goes in this direction as well. At weak coupling, you know the answer. It's n squared minus 1 times Vt cubed. Well, in order to give people a flavor of how a simple calculation goes, let me describe the two-point function. Yesterday, Dan Friedman gave us a much more detailed analysis of higher point functions, but to understand what's going on, I think it's very instructive just to take a look at the simplest case. Again, let's consider an S-wave dilaton, and we'll note some similarities between this calculation and the absorption cross-section calculations. So the relevant part of the supergravity, again, is just the kinetic term for the dilaton, which is the only piece of the supergravity action which is, in fact, quadratic in the dilaton. It is most efficient to reduce the action from 10 dimensions to 5 by integrating out the dependence on the phi sphere. Since we're in an S-wave, that's extraordinarily easy. This prefactor then collapses to n squared over 16 pi squared. And the general observation there is that all correlation functions computed by this means will have an n squared out front, and this is just, again, a reflection of Tuft scaling in the gauge theory. All planar diagrams find themselves with an overall factor of n squared and then extra factors of g squared n from vertices. Well, the action can be simplified further if you use the equation of motion for phi, and that's exactly what you want to do because you want to extremize the action. The solution to the equation of motion is subject to boundary conditions at z equals r, which are a plane wave, is given by modified Bessel functions. One could have tried to use the other modified Bessel function, I2 of kz, but that, in fact, would be a bad idea because it blows up in the interior of anti-de Sitter space, where z goes to infinity. Excluding this solution on the basis of its singular behavior at large z, is the analog of, in absorption calculations, excluding the outfalling solution to the Bessel equation and requiring that at the horizon the wave function be purely infalling. Well, to extract the two-point function, you just differentiate the relation I gave between W and the supergravity action twice. And I prefer to work in momentum space in general. It seems to be more efficient, at least for the two-point function, although for higher point functions, it's proved more convenient to work in position space. What you obtain is a two-point function for this operator curly O, which in the case of the dilaton is simply trace F squared. You obtain a two-point function of the form k to the fourth log k, and that's at leading order in kr. Actually, it's almost leading order. It's the leading non-analytic term, very reminiscent of the old calculations in matrix models. I don't mean matrix theory, but matrix models. There are in fact analytic terms in k squared which have even fewer powers of r, especially when you proceed to partial waves. There's a long series of such terms, but they reduce the contact terms in position space, so the only term you calculate, the only term you care about is the leading non-analytic term. And for your transforming, one in fact finds power law dependence for the two-point function, which is exactly what one must find in a conformal field theory. And I would note that in the end, in position space, the ultraviolet regulator has disappeared from the final expression, and so you can certainly take this limit where r goes to zero formally. And all it does is to remove any higher terms in kr, which I haven't included in my transparency. So similarly, one can work out the two-point function of the stress tensor by this means, and you find, in fact, the same answer as you found by absorption calculations, even though the flavor of this holographic computation is a little bit different. And that ensures, among other things, that there are no stray factors in the relation between the generating functional and the supergravity action. Well, just to speak briefly about tire partial waves, from the five-dimensional point of view, they obey a massive Klein-Gordon equation where the mass is related to the partial wave number. And the solution is the same as before, only the index of the Bessel functions changes. It is related to the mass, as I've written here. And the two-point function looks almost the same, but in fact, only the power of x changes. And so one concludes that the dimension of the operator coupling to the lth partial wave is related to the index of the Bessel function in a simple way. And in fact, since that was determined by the mass of the operator from a five-dimensional point of view, we have a very simple relation between dimensions of conformal operators and masses of the supergravity the masses of the supergravity fields which serve as their sources. For the lth partial wave, the dimension works out to be L plus 4, and the natural candidate one has for that operator is the trace of F squared times some product of L scalar fields arranged in an irreducible representation of SO6. Well, Igor and Polyakov and I conjectured that this mass dimension relation should continue to hold at least approximately in the full type 2B string theory. In type 2B string theory, except for the massless fields, the massless fields being the supergravity fields, except for those fields, all excited string states will have mass squareds on the order 1 over alpha prime. And so their dimensions turn out to be, in the gauge theory, proportional to the square root of the Tuft coupling. Well, it has been argued that, in fact, the Kaluza-Klein fields of type 2B supergravity map in a one-to-one fashion to the chiral primaries of n equals 4 super young mills plus their descendants. And since all the states in the type 2B string theory have masses on the order of the square root of the Tuft coupling, we are led to the conclusion that all operators whose dimensions aren't dictated by superconformal algebra, in fact, require a large dimension. And we might expect them even to freeze out of the operator product expansion so that the OPE almost closes on Carl's and their descendants. Since I'm running a little short on time, I'll just speed up a bit and discuss the Matthieu corrections to the cross-section again. The validity of the supergravity analysis, as Igor indicated, is not dependent on smallness of omega r. Certainly the validity of the matching procedure is, but now that we have this exact solution in terms of Matthieu functions, one can certainly consider at least corrections in omega r to the low energy limit, and that's what I want to do. Well, the question arises, this essentially begs the question, what world volume interpretation could the exact omega r dependence of the cross-section have? It certainly can't have anything to do with conformal field theory because there's now a scale, namely capital R. And so what I want to ask is, if we assume that there is some local description of the, some local low energy description of the absorption, what kind of quantum field theory might it be? Well, we know essentially there's a string theory description. You can use string diagrams to describe this absorption, but since we're at large open string coupling, those diagrams would generally want to have large numbers of boundaries that make it very difficult to compute. However, in the low energy limit, where 1 over omega is much greater than the string scale or the Planck scale, one can try to put together an action which reflects that strain structure for the two-point function. And since there are definite powers of R in that expansion, one expects that the Lagrangian should have terms of definite dimension. Furthermore, if you work things through a little bit, it seems like all the operators in the Lagrangian should have dimensions which are multiples of 4. They can be built out of, for instance, the square of the stress tensor at dimension 8. There also happens to be an SO singlet scalar, or even just the square of the SO singlet scalar at dimension 4. When you treat these non-renormalizable terms perturbatively, you do indeed get an expansion for the two-point function in the non-renormalizable theory, which matches supergravity in functional form at low orders in R. However, I would be the first to admit that I have no real insight on how to manage the non-renormalizable divergences and how to predict coefficients. So we may be in the right track. We may be on the right track here, but there's certainly a long ways to go. Well, let me finish with two brief thoughts, summarizing the main points of my talk. The limit where the energy is much less than 1 over r is a limit of decoupling between the bulk and the brain. In that limit, however, one can form a ratio of the cross-section and the gravitational coupling, which does approach a finite quantity, and that quantity is a discontinuity in the cut of a two-point function in the normalizable gauge theory. While this is an embryonic version of the holographic principle, which in hindsight should have suggested the generalization right away, the generalization is that the full generating functional of the connected Green's functions is essentially the supergravity action minimized subject to boundary conditions on the supergravity fields. We only trust that prescription at large Tuft coupling and with large gauge groups. However, one would expect that perhaps the full type 2B string theory in fact encapsulates the physics even at finite G squared N and at finite N. Thank you.
Questions? Tom. So Tom Banks asks if there is a transition amplitude interpretation of these amplitudes in anti-de Sitter space.
Well, I'm not sure if I have anything really insightful to say. I guess I would only say that it is that in the low energy limit, using some combination of ingoing and outgoing fields, you can set any boundary conditions you please at a particular radius in the three-brain geometry. And given those boundary conditions, one can then expect to use the holographic prescription to say what supergravity is doing in the throat. I'm not sure that really answers your question, but perhaps we can talk about it further together.
Other questions? Okay, let's go ahead and thank our speaker again.